Hi there, and welcome to the Business Beyond Borders podcast. I'm Cynthia Dearen, and on this show, I interview entrepreneurs who have become internationally successfully about why and how they did it. My guest today is Rob Rawson, CEO and co-founder of the company Staff.com, which created Time Doctor, a time tracking and productivity tool that helps remote teams work more effectively. Rob originally trained as a medical doctor, and he spent several years working in hospitals around Australia. But he discovered along the way that his real passion was starting and building businesses. And so after a few years as a doctor, he left medicine to pursue a full-time career as an entrepreneur. Rob had always had an interest in internet businesses, and so he had a number of online startups, including an online mapping site, a MySpace profiling site, a limousine directory, and some travel websites. He also found time to create and sell different types of software, including an online advertising agency, an online search engine optimization agency, a competitor to WhatsApp, and most bizarrely, a site designed to train individuals to improve their lie detection skills. But today, we're going to talk about how Rob and his co-founder, Liam Martin, created Time Doctor and how they went on to turn it into a global business. Rob, welcome to the show. It's great to have you here.
Yeah, nice to chat with you.
Now, you're joining me from Sydney. What is a typical day for you as a founder of Time Doctor look like?
Well, I have a team in 28 countries, so it's completely remote. And a typical day means, actually, I don't work that odd hours. I work some mornings, like 2 or 3 mornings. I work a little bit early. I work Wednesday evenings. But a lot of the time I'm working on strategy. I have like 10 hours of meetings a week with all of my team leaders. We've got over 50 people working in those 28 countries. So not sure that it's super typical. Like I have a certain amount that is like standard, like that maybe 20 hours a week is those meetings and things that I do every week. And then the other 20 is just strategy and new things and so on.
And what do you like to do when you are off duty and you're not, you know?
I've spent a lot of time with my kids. I've got a 3-year-old and a 5-year-old, and I like bushwalking. It's a big thing in Australia. Well, some people like it. We go into the bush, get bitten by snakes sometimes. No, I'm just kidding.
So this is going to be really interesting because a lot of people think, there's no way that I can run an international or a global business and have a young family. So we'll probably talk a bit about that a little later on today, but that's a great thing to start with, to see that you've got children of 3 and 5 and you're doing this anyway. Where I want to start though is to just to understand a little bit about your early life. And for context, you're a doctor, or you were a medical doctor. Well, perhaps you still are a medical doctor, and we'll talk about that too. But now you're an entrepreneur. So I want to know, if we look back into history, was there always this entrepreneurial bent in your personality? I mean, what were you like as a kid?
I was a little bit entrepreneurial as a kid. I did do some coaching as a kid, and I was experimenting with pricing, actually. I remember trying to increase the prices of my maths coaching, and I went up from like $30 to $35, and I just tried to go and see whether people would drop off. So that was like an entrepreneurial thing when I was, I guess, 17, 18. But I wasn't truly entrepreneurial until I went to a few different personal development seminars. I think that's kind of sparked my idea of being entrepreneurial and wanting to be successful in business.
When was that? Was that as a teenager or older?
Yeah, from about 17, 18. And then even during med school, I was doing a lot of entrepreneurial things. So I was taking time off. I took a whole year off medicine to be a marketing consultant because I read all this stuff from Jay Abraham. I'm not sure if you heard of him. He's like a marketing guru.
Yep.
And so I thought, I'm a marketing guru now, so I'm going to go. And I put an ad in the paper saying, I can double your business guaranteed. And then I got people that responded to the ad, and then I tried to double their business and kind of failed. So that was my first business venture.
And this is really interesting because, I mean, I think what you did was pretty unusual for a doctor. And I say that because my dad is a doctor, and he knew he wanted to be a doctor from the time he was 8 years old. And that became his vocation. And that is what he's done ever since. And I know that there are a lot of You know, that is often the way with medicine. So tell me, how did you wind up in medicine and how did you balance the demands of doing the training of a medical doctor, which is intense, against, you know, starting marketing businesses and doing all the other things that you did?
I didn't have a desire from the beginning to go into medicine. I actually got the marks in school to do medicine, but I did a year of electrical engineering and I didn't really know what I wanted to do. Yes. And then I had a sudden inspiration, yes, I'm going to do medicine. And part of the reason was that I thought this is on the cutting edge and there's a lot of really interesting stuff about it I just hadn't considered before. But like, to be perfectly honest, I know this is going to sound weird, but I thought, man, maybe it'll make me more attractive to women, like to at some deeper level. Like to be really, really honest, I know that's a crazy thing to say. It's like a little bit embarrassing, but it was kind of, I mean, medicine is amazing and I kind of, I actually do miss it. I think it's one of those things you can't do half of the time. A lot of doctors are complaining like, medicine's terrible, you know, it's awful. And I think that's really not correct. It's a really amazing profession, but you really have to dedicate your life to it. You can't be like half a doctor. And I think once you go down an entrepreneurial path, you sort of, I got really excited about that. And I wanted to live and work from anywhere in the world. That was like my initial goal, to be financially successful and to be able to work from anywhere and to travel around the world while working, which I did do. And that at that point, I'd sort of been out of medicine for like 5-10 years, and it's kind of very hard to go back. Like there's so much to learn and know. So
how far did you get through? Did you complete your training?
Yeah, I completed the training and I did, I did a year of internship and then I did 2-3 years of working in hospitals, in country hospitals. Very, very challenging, very hard stuff. Like you deal with some very difficult things there.
And where were you? Which bit of the country were you in?
I was in a town called Kempsey, which is probably not the best socioeconomic area. A lot of people are unemployed and a lot of people have problems with alcohol. And I would probably estimate that 50% of the people in the hospital was from self-inflicted things. And when I say self-inflicted, I mean they got drunk and they fell over, or they, you know, very basic things like that. Not that they ate a lot of food and they got a heart attack, a lot of junk food. So it was really, that was something that I probably didn't like in terms of medicine. But what I did like is the challenge and the interesting nature of just very, very interesting problems and also meeting people and things like that.
So tell me, you did your time as an intern and then time in rural hospitals. What was the catalyst that really pushed you out of medicine and into a new space? And just walk me through the story of that. How did that happen?
I had a goal to have the ability to work anywhere I wanted to. So I was on the side, I was doing different businesses. I was doing internet businesses. And so I was working 1 week a month as a doctor. It was actually quite good because you could work basically double shifts for 1 week and you could earn enough money, and the other 3 weeks I could work on business. So that's what I was doing. I only actually quit medicine once I was earning more in business than as a doctor. So from financially it was not a hard decision, but I think in retrospect, at the time it wasn't hard also from the point of view of leaving medicine, because I didn't sort of value it as much as I would now, where I think, wow, it's an amazing profession. But I really, you know, I can't do both. So that's ultimately, I don't regret leaving because I know I can't do both and I really love being an entrepreneur.
And so what was the time gap between leaving medicine and starting Time Doctor?
So I was already doing other internet businesses before Time Doctor, and I was doing it at the same time as medicine. And then as soon as I was earning more money than being as a doctor, I thought, oh, I'm just going to travel around the world and do this internet business and leave medicine. So I did that. At that time, I wasn't 100% certain whether I was going to leave medicine forever. But so I did that for a few years. It was a Time Doctor and it came later as a product that I developed from my own team, because I had a team in the Philippines and I went over to the Philippines to build up this team and to kind of outsource and have a whole team of developers, etc. And then I wanted to get rid of the office there, and I wanted to have software to make sure that everyone was productive, even if I wasn't there in the same office and I'd never kind of meeting with people in person. So that's how I created the software.
So let's talk about how Time Doctor got started, because you've got a co-founder, Liam Martin, right?
Yes.
Now, where is he at the moment? Because we're speaking in Sydney. Where's Liam today? Yeah.
He's in Canada. He's in Ottawa, Canada. It's the other side of the world. And surprisingly, it's working fairly well.
How did you guys meet first?
We met actually at a conference called South by Southwest, which is a conference for technology. And we met through another friend. Actually, I did a podcast. How this all happened, it all comes from podcasts. I did a podcast. Then I met this lady who was also a friend of Liam's, and then she introduced us at South by Southwest. Oh, she introduced me to South by Southwest. We went to South by Southwest and I met him there. So it all came from a podcast.
Wow, that's amazing. And so you guys got on and you went, let's establish the Time Doctor, or...
I had already started, and so Liam saw what it was. It was in the beginning stages before we were making money. Mm-hmm. So he joined actually after I'd already started it, but before we were making money.
And just tell me, you said that you were already doing other businesses and you went to Thailand. And so... To the Philippines.
That's all right.
So you actually created Time Doctor, which is essentially a software, because you wanted to shut down your office in the Philippines, but you still wanted to be able to manage your team who were working there. Is that right?
Yes. I wanted everyone to work from home. Mm-hmm. I didn't want to go back to the Philippines anymore. I was kind of sick of living in the Philippines. So I wanted to continue to have the team to travel around the world, but not have to be constantly drawn back to the office. Because if you have the office there, you always kind of want to go there. So I wanted to get rid of the office. Plus, it's expensive, right? It was quite expensive.
So when you started to do that, was a pretty new thing at the time. I'm thinking that there probably wasn't a lot of software around at the time that could do that.
No, that's true. I think we were probably one of the first software that was designed around that need.
And how did you do that? Because as I understand it, you know, you have a background with some engineering in it, and you have medicine and you did marketing, but who did you work with to actually...
We started with just a lot of trial and error and a lot of mistakes. I started posting on these different sites like Upwork and the precursors to Upwork and freelancer.com. So I tried multiple times, like 5-6 times, to try and find somebody who could actually build it. And most of the time was complete failure. Sometimes it was like a half, you know, they could build a little bit, but it was very slow. Eventually I found someone who was able to build it. And then I just took it from there and then started building a bigger team, and it grew from there.
So just paint a picture for me of what the first few years were like with Time Doctor. What did it look like?
We had initially was building it for myself, right? So I was initially building it that I could use it for my team. Mm-hmm. And we had a small number of developers. Then I started doing some blogging, some content marketing. So we got more people to use it from the content marketing. Then it started to build up as a free user base. Then we decided, well, we've got to start charging. So we started charging. And then it just built up slowly, really steadily and slowly from there. We started charging in 2012. So that's like 6 years ago. We just continually worked on trying to improve the product, hiring and improving the team. Like, we're constantly building out the team and working on how do we hire really, really great developers in our team. So that's a very, very big focus. And also responding to the needs of the customer as much as we could. So we had our own needs that we were actually using the software, but also responding to the needs, constantly asking them, what do they need? What else do you want to do? But we certainly made a lot of mistakes in all areas, like in terms of the product development and hiring developers, etc.
So there are probably some people listening to this show right now thinking, I don't really understand what this software does. So for those people, can you just explain for us in a bit of detail, what does the Time Doctor software actually do?
Yeah, so it's for people that are working usually full time, but on an hourly basis, where you're paying someone an hourly basis, and often or usually they're remote, so they're not next to you, and you want to have a way to track their time and also accountability about time so that you know that they're really tracking and working in the time that they're saying that they're working. So for example, if you have on Upwork, if you've heard of Upwork, it has a kind of a software like that. So this is a way to actually do that without using a platform such as Upwork. So Upwork, you can do all of this. You can hire these remote people, but it costs 20% of the person's salary. And a lot of people, they want to just hire the person directly, or they have a contact. And so they need a software like ours to make sure that they feel the person is productive. So it's time tracking, but also accountability about productivity.
And from what you're saying, it seems that one of the advantages that your software has is that it offers a competitive advantage over a platform like Upwork, because I'm wondering whether maybe using Time Doctor software is less expensive than hiring somebody through Upwork in terms of percentage of salary that, you know, that you then have to allocate.
Yeah, definitely. You don't have to. Yeah, a lot of people are directly hiring people around the world now. So that they might have an assistant in the Philippines, they might have a team. And this is a common thing in Sydney or more expensive cities. If you wanted to hire a developer in Sydney, you're looking at $100,000 Australian minimum. And it's, if you can find someone. So that's a big if, right? Because it's very, very hard to find someone good in Sydney. And 100,000 is actually a low salary. So you really need to have the skills to be able to, and this is where hiring remotely really is so much more effective, because you're expanding your network to the entire globe. So imagine, yes, Sydney is 5 million. It seems like a lot of people, but compared to 8 billion people, or say, I'm not sure how many people there are on the planet, but it's a lot more than 5 million. It's just insanely more people that you could actually hire, and there's so much more talent available, whether it's hiring at the same salary and just a better level of person, or hiring at a lower salary and a more affordable salary. Like, it's all sorts of options, but it's just an incredible advantage to do that.
And we're going to come back and talk a bit more about global teams in a little while. Before we get there, though, I wanted to talk to you about how you grew the global footprint. And I guess in a way, because of the kind of company you are and because of the kind of product that you're offering, Time Doctor is really a born global company, isn't it? I mean, you set the company up specifically so that you could put you as the end user, or really the client, as well as the founder, could be in one country, and the people who you wanted to work with were a couple of continents away.
Yep, that's definitely the case, that it's really connecting people across countries. So, but in terms of how did I have a global footprint, really it's when we post a job, there are certain places, and when we look for people, there's places that are more appropriate for hiring globally, and yes, we don't look at the person's country, except that now we do look a little bit at the time zone. So we might not want certain time zones, because sometimes the time zone is an issue. But for example, if I want someone in the general Australian time zone, then the whole of India, the whole of Asia is all okay, because that person is like, we just look at the talent, and we don't look at all of the other, don't look at the location. We just look at what can they do? Can they pass our tests? We have very rigorous tests for each job position. And I don't care where they're from. I don't care what color, you know, what race, what religion. It's just,
can they do the work?
Yes.
Absolutely. Now, your supply side, if you like, is international. What about the client side? Is that equally as international? Do you have clients from all around the world?
We do as well. It's number one is the US, and then Australia is up there, and we've got UK, but also we've got quite a few clients in the Philippines, in Russia, and other countries like that as well.
So how did you go about actually getting those international clients? Because I think that a key hurdle for many micro to medium-sized companies looking to expand overseas or to sell internationally is this question of, oh my gosh, how do I actually get those customers, especially at the beginning? How do I get those initial customers in all these different countries? How can I do that effectively? How do I do it in a way that doesn't break my budget? What do you do?
Well, when you're doing content marketing, for example, you're by default, you're targeting the whole world because anybody can find your content. And so only if you're doing some kind of marketing, which is specifically targeted at a country, when you have an online business, you actually are really targeting the whole world. We have more recently translated our website into 3 different languages, which is a huge effort and has paid off a little bit, but is quite difficult, I would say. So the globalization is not dependent on getting the language or the translation. I think the translation is more of a later stage thing. We probably did it a little bit earlier than we needed to. And really the globalization is just getting out there on the internet, really, because if you have the product that people want in different time zones in different countries, it depends on your product, I guess.
Now, I have had conversations with people recently on this show where they've said, if you want to go international, you have to have boots on the ground. You have to be there yourself. You cannot do it remotely. You can't get clients remotely. Would you offer a counter view to that? Because it seems to me that you've done most of what you've done through content marketing. Is that close to the truth?
I think content marketing is a big thing. Also integrations with other software. So for example, we integrate with Basecamp, Asana, Trello, Jira, things like that. So we get, if somebody's looking at the Jira directory or the Asana directory, they might find us on there. So that's a good path as well. But in terms of do you need to have boots on the ground? I think it depends on your sales model. If you want to have salespeople actually in the country, then I think it is much better. A lot of business models do require having a person that's actually selling. Mm-hmm. And we're moving more into that, or actually just at the moment hiring a salesperson in South America. So yes, in Portuguese and in Spanish, and it's a little bit unproven. We just started it. So I think that's like another evolution, but I don't think there's a, you must do. I think there's, if you are doing sales, I think it's quite hard to do sales remotely, because that's just my experience. We are doing sales remotely, so we've had some success with it, but I think that it is more difficult because the kind of feeling, like for salespeople, they really need to then be constantly calling people, and they need to be very motivated to do that. And if they're doing it from home, it's a little bit more difficult. Yeah. But I don't think it's impossible. I think none of these things have absolute rules. There's very few things in business that have absolute rules.
So just to, I just want to dig in a little bit to what you did initially. So you did content marketing and you did integration. On the content marketing piece, what did you actually do? I mean, did you do blogs? Did you do podcasts? Did you do...
We haven't done podcasts until more recently. We did more blog articles and some articles on other blogs. So for example, we tried to get onto business.com and other sites like that, which was effective. And generally the content marketing is very, very long term. So a lot of our traffic actually really came from referrals and people just looking for a solution, and they referred someone or they wrote an article about us, which is very, very organic and just takes a long time to build. But the content marketing was the spark. So you put out some kind of article, then they find that, and then they refer, then they start using it, and then they refer it, etc. So those two are very big. The other big marketing angles is the sales, which we're just starting, which is the having an internal sales team that calls all of our leads, which we didn't really do before. And the other thing is split testing and conversion optimization. It's not actually generating the leads, but it's hugely important for, it's probably one of the most important things that we've done, is just to constantly improve our website and the conversion of when people go there. Do they actually sign up and do they use the product?
Okay. And so those are really your top channels in terms of getting people to come to you.
Yes. Yes.
What type of clients and industries do you usually work with? I mean, is there a trend in a direction or another, or is it very diverse?
Actually, number one is marketing agencies, more digital agencies, and also development houses. So they might have an offshore designer or developer that works on their team, or a bunch of offshore people. So they kind of look towards our product because of that. Because often that's the number one use case, is somebody in Australia, they have a digital agency, and then they have like 5 developers in Ukraine, and then they use our product for tracking efficiency of their team. So that's that's kind of our number one market. And then we've got all kinds of other online businesses like e-commerce and all sorts of things.
And how similar or how different have you found your clients in the different markets where they're located? I mean, are your Russian clients very different in terms of your Philippines clients or your American clients in terms of what they expect?
I don't know if I have a proper answer for that. I'd love to know that. That's probably something I should know more about, is how different they are. And I think there are some differences between the different countries. For example, I thought in the beginning that, for example, the companies in India or the Philippines would want a lower price and they wouldn't accept our pricing. But based on the sales calls, we have been able to get people to accept our full price in India. So that's actually not something that was necessarily true in our initial thoughts. And there are some management styles that may be different as well. The management styles of Westerners are a bit more open and a bit more kind of accepting. And the management styles of the people in the more developing countries might be a bit more didactic. So that may come into it.
And we've talked about the difference, so the difference between, say, for example, a Time Doctor and an Upwork. But, you know, since you started Time Doctor, there has been a proliferation of companies who do similar things to what you do. What are the strategies that you've used in a, you know, in this very competitive global space to really differentiate yourself from the competition?
I think that's really true about the competition. When you're doing a SaaS business, a global SaaS business, SaaS means software as a service. It's an amazing business model because you can get people from anywhere in the world and you can hire people from anywhere in the world. So it's great, but you're also competing with every single business in the world. So that's like the downside, right? So in order to compete, what we're trying to do is to focus on the core need of our market, which is for people who really want to understand that their team are productive. So there's all sorts of areas that we could get into. Like we could start doing more invoicing, we could start doing more project management type stuff. But we're really trying to focus on what is the core need, and then we're trying to make our product as good as it possibly can be, and focusing on marketing. And then even though there is a lot of competition, to be quite honest, it's actually not that competitive compared to most other online market. So you said it's competitive, but yeah, at this stage, it's not as competitive because it's a relatively, it depends what market you look at. Like if you look at time tracking, it's more competitive than the more time tracking with productivity, which is more of a niche market.
Yes. Now, when you go on an entrepreneurial journey, there are some pretty big highs, but usually in my experience, there are some really hard times as well. Can you just pick one of the times that you found really challenging with running this global business and just tell me about it and about how you actually faced up to it and dealt with it?
Recently, it hasn't been quite as bad because I've kind of got used to it. But before, it was quite a lot of times when they, if you've heard this term, champagne and razor blades, it's like the one yeah. minute you're like, oh, this is the best thing. We are going to be like the best business. And then literally the next day, like it's not even like weeks away. It's like the next day you're like, oh no, we're going to die. Like the business is dead. Like that's how crazy it is when you're doing a startup. So it's really funny, but one example obviously would be when the site goes down and I'm not a system administrator, so I can't do anything about it. So it's a very frustrating thing if the site goes down and really people are completely relying on our service. So that's happened multiple times in the past. And I think we've got better procedures for dealing with it now, but still really very, very difficult and like nerve-wracking kind of experience to try and deal with it. And like when I can't deal with it, like I literally just have to depend on other people.
Yeah. And that must be hard when it's your company and you want to get in there and fix it and make it all right.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah, I have tried to do that. Like I tried to log into Amazon web server and I'm looking at the console and I'm like, no, there's no way. This is just way above my head.
That is an experience that resonates with me, I have to say. I want to kind of segue now into talking about the global teams aspect of the business and digging into that a bit. And I guess I want to start with a question about how you run this business with Liam, given that you are in Sydney and Liam is in Canada. How do you make that work?
So we have two meetings a week, and they're about 1.5 hours for one meeting, and the other one's usually only 30 minutes. So I actually find that's perfect, to be honest. Like, I actually don't like the constant kind of meeting throughout the whole week, because you're really interrupting each other and you're not getting focused. So from that perspective, it's really good. It's also good that he's in North America. There's a lot of stuff that he can do in terms of networking. He can meet people and do things over there that I can't do. So that's a good thing as well, having people in two different time zones. So I would say having my co-founder Liam in the different areas, and we've got completely different responsibilities, it hasn't been an issue. What is an issue is if people in the same team are in different time zones, and then if you have to constantly collaborate. So people in the same team, you might have 5 people or 10 people in the product team or the design team. And if they're in different time zones, that's hugely problematic, because they do need to communicate more often and they need to be updating each other. And that really does slow things down. Two time zones that are a little bit apart is okay. But as you start getting Europe plus North America plus Australia, it's a disaster. If the 3 people on the team in those 3 time zones, it's really not a good idea.
We have a finance team in Chennai. We have a team in the United States. We have a team here. We've got people in other places as well. But just for that example, we find it really difficult, because we need my general manager to often be in a finance and budgeting meeting, but getting Sydney, Chennai and San Francisco all on a call at one time is actually quite difficult.
Yeah. And I think also because people are working from home, they're generally more flexible about their working hours. So most people, the guys in Canada, are working evenings, 1 or 2 evenings at least per week. Mm-hmm. And that's to coordinate with the people in Asia. So they do need to work. If you have everyone in an office and they're working 9 to 5, and so the people in Canada are working 9 to 5 in office, the people in Australia are working 9 to 5 in office, that doesn't work because there's not enough overlap. But if you have some overlap where people are willing to work nights, you know, so it depends on the culture and how it overall works.
So let's talk about managing a remote team, because this is a field where you've got a lot of experience. What do you think are some of the big mistakes that you see people make when they're trying to manage a global team? You know, what's the recipe for having a really awful global team?
I think lack of communication is really common, because when you are not there in the same room, you don't bump into each other. A lot of businesses run by bumping into each other. Oh, I just remember I have to do that. You know, oh, I just remember I have to tell you something. But that doesn't work if you're in the other side of the world. You need to have a structured approach. And the other thing is you need to kind of replace some of those feelings and experiences. So video calls, I think, are absolutely essential. Everyone should be on video, and we demand that the team is on video when they're on calls. And if you're within a team, really, it should be daily video calls, a little stand-up meeting, 5-10 minutes. And that's to kind of replace the feeling that you get whether you're in the same office. Like, if you're just working away by yourself and you don't even talk to someone on video, it feels like you're completely disconnected. And also, I really like, so it's a meeting rhythm thing that's really important. So I like the weekly meeting where you have a one-on-one with different team leaders. So I have a weekly meeting with each team leader that I'm is directly reporting to me, and they kind of build up all of the issues that they want to talk about through the week, and then we talk about it strategically there. So I don't need to meet with all my team leaders daily, but within smaller teams, I think it's great if they can do daily.
Does that mean you're a fan of Patrick Lencioni and the 5 Dysfunctions of a Team? Do you know that book?
I've heard of the book, but I haven't read it recently, at least. I've read a lot of books, so I can't remember if I read that one or not.
That one, I mentioned that one because he really advocates what you're talking about, even for teams in the same place, where you have this meeting, this rhythm of meetings, where you have a daily stand-up meeting, a weekly meeting, a monthly meeting, and then a quarterly or every 4 months meeting, and then probably an annual meeting. So there is this constant sequence of meetings happening which keep the team on the same page and in touch with each other.
Yeah. The other thing is you can have a conflict if you have some of the team is in office and some are remote. Then what happens is the people in office, like, let's have a meeting, and they all get in an office together, and then the people who are remote are excluded. Or even if they're included, they don't feel the same because they're not actually in the same environment, because they're, you know, one group's in an office and the other's like all on their screen. So actually companies that do this really well, even if they're in an office, they each sit in front of their computer to have the meeting, which is kind of weird. Like, why don't they get in the meeting room? But it actually makes a lot of sense, because now everyone's on the same level for that meeting.
And everyone can see each other too, which I suppose is a big plus.
Yes.
What about cultural mistakes that you see people make? There must be some of these when you've got people working from all around the world together.
Yeah, I think there's cultural issues with certain countries that that we work with, where they might not speak up, they might not have as much of an opinion, or they might not be as proactive in terms of getting things done. And that's something that can slowly change and improve as they kind of adjust to a more Western culture. So that's one thing. It's very critical that people don't have any conflict about religion. Or we have in our team people from multiple different religions, and so that's like an unacceptable thing, is any kind of discrimination about religion, race, or gender, or, you know, sexual orientation, things like that. So that's like a core fundamental value, which is we've got a list of values. That's one of them, which we haven't generally found as a problem, though. Yeah. Most people. Yeah, but there is a problem, or we have had problems with people not really communicating effectively, not being connected, that kind of thing. So it's something that we're still improving and working on. And when we meet in person, we're meeting in person for the whole team the first time this year in Bali. It's going to be amazing. And every time we meet in person as a team, it really builds a much deeper level of connection. And I think it's really important to do that as much as you can as well.
So if you're going to boil your kind of best practice tips for managing a global team down to, I don't know, a top five.
Yeah, I can give you a few more specifics as well.
Yeah, please.
Because there's just some details, like Zoom, which we're actually using for this right now, is incredibly effective for meetings. So I would just basically recommend Zoom for now for all meetings, and having video on for all meetings, having a meeting probably once a day, but definitely several times a week via video. Each person should be participating via video several times a week. Also, using a project management software to organize your tasks is really important, not to have things all over the place. So that's a few. Another one that's really important is actually recording your screen. So having software such as I use Snagit. There's some other ones called Use Loom, and they're both free. Use Loom is free and actually records your screen while you have a video, and you can explain, like, you click here, you do that. And sometimes it's hard to actually share screen and to coordinate the time, but you can record a quick video and send it to someone, and you can also use that for training as well. So those are some of the things. Obviously, systems and procedures is another thing. So you're having checklists of when you're hiring people and those types of things. And then probably the most important thing is who you're hiring, which is the same for any business really, but it's critical for remote. We generally try and hire two people for every position. And people, because they don't have the kind of discipline of coming into the office, they're just not necessarily, some people are not as reliable, or they don't really have what it takes to actually be disciplined and to actually follow through. So you find that if you're hiring remotely, sometimes they do drop off, and that's actually one of the advantages, that you can really have more than one person trialing for the same job. It's a bit easier to do remotely. So there's a lot of things that you can do that add up.
And do you trial people who you want to hire before you interview them? You know, do you get them to do
we have a process
or something? And can you just tell me about that really quickly?
Yeah, so each type of job is different, but we have a software that we use, Breezy, which is actually, I can highly recommend it. I'm not affiliated with it, but it's amazing. And that software actually has a pipeline where you go through, and one of the steps could be you're interviewing people with a video, and you actually go through, and each step is calculated depending on the person that you want. So for example, we're hiring a project manager, and the first step might be to send us one is about 5 questions, and one of them is the salary, and then one of them is like send us some project requirements that you've written before. So we look and see that if they have detailed project requirements, and the next step they send a video just to see if they can communicate clearly in English, etc. And then the next step might be an interview after that in this case, and then the next step after that will be actually some 2 or 3 series of tests that they will do, which are paid tests, because then our principle is generally if it's less than 1 hour, we might ask the person to do it for free. But if it's more than 1 hour, we pay for every test that the person does, because it's kind of unfair to ask them. I know Google probably gets you to do 5-hour tests for free, but we're not Google, and it's not a fair thing to ask.
How do you build the company culture, given that you're all around the world? And what is your company culture like?
We do have a culture, and it's something I'm still working on. We do have sometimes problems with it. I would say our culture first and foremost is the remote thing, right? And we have these values that what I'm doing right now is actually having the values and our mission and vision printed out, and everybody is going to have it on their desk. So they're actually going to have a stand with a photograph stand with it's on the desk, so they can have it next to them all the time. So that includes things like the remote thing, the acceptance of other people. And so those are the things. Some of them are not 100% there. Like, for example, being proactive is one of the culture. I would say that some of our team are really proactive and some are not. So that's something that we're working on. So, yeah, culture. We also have things like a water cooler or a coffee chat once a week, which kind of works. Like in our support team right now, they're doing a games night where they're once a week they do for 1 hour. They actually play games, video games, because they're not really meeting socially. So that's another thing that they do. It's culture sometimes hard to define, isn't it? It's like it's there, but it's a little bit hard to define it. And one of the problems is because people are not there all of the time, you don't even necessarily know if they are following the culture or how they are. But that has advantages too. Like that whole style of operating, like I talk to other business owners and they would go insane if they had 50 staff, because they'd be constantly bugged and they'd be constantly interrupted. And that doesn't happen because I'm here. Like I literally have no actually employees or other people in my company in my office. So it's just me. So it actually gives me a lot of space and freedom. So it has a huge advantage for the business owner as well.
Now, there is a flip side to that, though, and that is that you have to motivate yourself to, you know, get out of bed and make sure you don't wear pajamas to work every day because there's nobody looking at you. What keeps you motivated to keep getting up every morning and running the show?
I like the overall vision of doing something big on the internet. I know that I'm actually exploring that right now. I'm a part of an entrepreneurs organization, so it's like the thing that I'm exploring is what is my real vision, because I'm kind of at the stage or very close to the stage where I don't need to work for money. So if you don't need to work for money, then what are you really working for? So that's a really good question. I think my overall answer is that I want to do something that makes a difference on the internet, that I really enjoy, that as a very successful company, and then I want to give the money away to charity. So that's my like long-term vision. That's more than myself. But if part of it, like if I'm really like honest, is like, I want to do it big. I want to be successful. I don't know if that's the right answer, but it's kind of true, is that that's like, I want to have a really successful business that's really, that and I want it to be meaningful. So like there's certain decisions that I'm making, like certain element of our company has this like employee monitoring aspect to it. And I want to kind of actually change that, because that's not an inspiration for me for the 20-year kind of view. So there's that element of what is it doing in the world. Like I really like how Time Doctor is helping people to be able to work remotely. So I'm kind of working towards that vision a bit.
I love it. So, you know, we've talked about motivation. What about inspiration? You said that you like to read and you've read lots of books. Are there favorite books that you've come across over time, whether they're business books or nonfiction or fiction or cartoons, whatever it is? Are there favorite books that you have come across that have really made an impact on your life or got you to see things differently or given you a moment of inspiration?
I've been doing more podcasts at the moment rather than books because of the time to actually read. And by the time I've read it, I've kind of like it's assimilated and then I've like half forgotten it. So there's Vern Harnish, The Rockefeller Habits is just one that I'd recommend in general to business owners. And any lean startup, if you're doing a startup, the Eric Ries and any other kind of lean startup kind of things is really, really powerful, I think. Yeah. So those are two things that come to mind. Also, Getting Things Done by Robert Allen is another one.
And we will we'll list all of those in the show notes afterwards so that people can go and check them out and find them if they're interested to do that. And what about people? Are there any people that have made a particular impact on you?
I really like Warren Buffett. The reason that I like him is because he's very folksy. You know, he's in the same house, even though he's one of the richest people in the world. And he is very, really loves what he's doing. And he espouses having high integrity and kind of the simplicity of being like super, super wealthy, but not having to have a expensive yachts or, you know, that kind of thing that you're doing it for. And also the fact that he's giving all his money away to charity, which is making a huge difference in the world. So those things are really inspiring to me. I really like that kind of that concept. Yeah.
So what is, we've talked a bit about what you would like to do next. What's next for Time Doctor?
We have a goal to get 1 million paid users. So we're at about 30,000 now. So we've got quite a long way to go to that. So we're working towards making the product really much more effective and having better dashboards and just a lot of product improvements and just slow and steady improvements over many years. Also, there's a bit of technical debt that we're refactoring. So there's a bunch of stuff with the product that we're working on.
How can people get in touch with you?
If you want to probably just contact the via the contact us form on Time Doctor, that might be the best. Yep, you can also connect with me on LinkedIn as well, although I don't always necessarily read my LinkedIn emails. I think I filter them out.
So again, we will put the details of that that contact page, and if you would like us to, we can put your LinkedIn onto the show notes, and then, you know, if you decide to look at LinkedIn and people connect with you, you can chat to them there. Rob, it's been really fascinating and really fun having you on the show today. Have you got some final thoughts for business owners who are listening to this podcast and thinking, I wonder if this going global thing is really for me?
Just one thing that I would say is just to really have a thought about doing something that's 10 times bigger than you ever thought you dreamed possible before, because as soon as you have that in your mind, it may set you down a much more successful path. And we limit ourselves. Like I limit myself. I've limited myself multiple times, even though I'm a big thinker, but I still limit myself. And as soon as I start thinking that in that bigger direction, even maybe if I don't achieve it, I think it gets me a lot further towards my goals. So that's something that I'm really always think about how to 10x or how to not just incremental, but like be, you know, blow things out of the water and be much, take 10 times more action as well. Like how could you take 10 times more action towards if something's working, just keep doing it a lot more than you are right now. How could you do that? So that's some parting thoughts.
We were just talking a little moment ago about the fact that you're running a remote conference in a few weeks' time. Can you tell us about where that is, when it's on, and what it's about?
So it's actually in Bali on the 23rd of June. So we're actually, we've got some great speakers such as the CEO of Buffer and people from Atlassian and GitLab. These are all companies that are completely remote and that run businesses like for example, Atlassian has a huge remote contingent and GitHub is a $1 billion company and it's completely remote. So it's really, really interesting to learn from these people. So this is our first conference that we've organized. We can also give your listeners a discount code as well. I know it's probably on a short timeline. I don't know when this podcast is going to go live, but there's also a podcast there and we'll be doing it in the next year as well, runningremote.com.
We will put the details for that and the promo, the link to the promo code and the link to the registration into the show notes. So if you are interested in getting some good oil on working remotely and hearing from some amazing speakers and also having a fab time in Bali, then you might want to check out the remote working conference. Thanks for joining me today.
Okay, really nice to chat.